Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, live from the Bay, working on very little sleep, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. The Golden State Warriors are champions. Kevin Durant is Finals MVP. The fans here in the Bay Area are so excited and so relieved. But before we get to any of this, I have a question that I need you to answer. You're the only person who can answer it.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw a few days ago, Draymond Green was flapping his mouth with some comments about the citizens of Cleveland. He said, "I don't pay much attention to anybody in Cleveland. They don't seem to be the sharpest people around." When I first heard that comment, I realized that I knew the sharpest guy around. I knew Sharp. There is no one sharper than Sharp. Sharp is the sharpest. Please, Andrew, can you tell me right now, are the people of Cleveland sharp, sharper, or sharpest? And did you agree with Draymond Green's conclusion?
Okay, so you warned me that you were coming off the top rope with an extremely corny intro. And you told me not to bail out and to just go with it. And so I'm going to go with it and say that the people of Cleveland are exactly as sharp as we thought all along. I appreciate Draymond's. Yeah, you know, whatever you thought about Cleveland is still true. And shout out to Draymond. He was entertaining throughout the series, entertaining last night. And yeah, I'm not any sharper than anyone. Let me just say that.
Oh, no, no, you are the sharpest.
I don't know. I have my moments where I'm not quite as sharp. But look, man, it's time. Let's talk. This is your moment. Last night was the culmination of several months of standing for Kevin Durant. And I kind of want to just give you the floor to let you sort of bask in this.
It was a crazy night last night, just all around. I don't think that Durant was the only story, but I think he was one of the lead stories. First of all, I don't want anyone to sweep this under the rug. The nerves in the first half of that game in the Oracle Arena stands were very real. Very, very real. The more LeBron James was pushing that game towards the second half, the more Kyrie Irving just seemed unstoppable off the dribble. There was fright. You know, there was legitimate fear. I guess I would ask you real quick. I mean, how close did you think that was the game, or when did you think that game was decided?
Not until the fourth. You know, yeah. I had a feeling there was just sort of a weird vibe to it. As soon as Cleveland fought back to make it single digits in the third quarter, there was enough drama to make it interesting. Granted, the entire time I kind of knew the Warriors were going to win. But we should take this opportunity now to appreciate LeBron and Kyrie for going so nuts that they actually made the final three games of this series watchable. They were great.
Oh, great, great point. And I think we should also take a moment to appreciate Kyrie Irving, who I've never really known if I totally bought what he was selling in terms of a lot of his media comments. He just kind of rubs me the wrong way sometimes with how he presents himself. But we should also give him major props for his LeBron James speech that he gave after the game in terms of what LeBron does as a leader, setting the tone, never cutting corners, dealing with the media, just the entire responsibility that goes with being LeBron. I thought Kyrie summed it up beautifully. It's on my Twitter if you haven't read it or haven't seen the clip. I don't know. I was sitting there in the press conference. I had goosebumps from what Kyrie said. But in terms of, you know, Golden State.
Yeah, we can't bury the lead. Can I tell you something? We've been, first of all, on the last podcast, I was not in the greatest mood. And I think I promised that we weren't going to talk about the finals after the Warriors won, which we're going to deviate. We got a lot of great questions for our next podcast about the rest of the league. I'm excited to start talking about the rest of the league. I think we're overdue. We've had a lot of finals takes over the last couple of weeks. But for now, we need to talk about KD and Golden State. And I was sitting at home imagining like a Jerry Maguire, Rod Tidwell interaction with you two, where you just sort of embrace after the game. Sort of congratulate him on his breakthrough.
Yeah, you got me all wrong. I mean, I think it was an exciting night, but if we want to go inside baseball with this, you know, I'm sitting next to Lee Jenkins, who wrote a 4,000-word masterpiece on Durant and
he
sort of just his entire run here. coming up to this title. And the crazy part about watching it unfold live is realizing that that story hangs in the balance. And not only should we give credit to like the Cavaliers for trucking through the emotions and the Warriors for kind of fighting through, let's give credit to Lee too, because that was a stomach-turning night for him, wondering whether that story was even going to see the light of day, whether Golden State had kind of choked this away or not. But you look at KD, I thought he had the answers in terms of making the key shots. He started the run, the 22-2 run in the second quarter, which first blew it open. Yeah. When the lead cut to five in the fourth quarter, he had the big three. Down the stretch, the interplay between KD and Steph was excellent, setting up lots of high percentage looks, just continuing to get scores when they needed scores. So I think from a basketball standpoint, he answered every question. Everything that I said previously about, look, hate his decision, hate his motives, question his character, whatever, you still have to respect him on the court. I stand by all of that. I think it was completely underscored, and that's why he walks home as unanimous finals MVP. The scene afterwards, in terms of their celebration, was very giddy, exuberant. I don't know if that's like Draymond setting the tone as just kind of a giddy guy, but that was their whole vibe. I was kind of standing in the tunnel as they came off the court. You know, Durant's mother comes through and says, "Mama's here, baby," and you know she's handing out high fives. That was a terrible impression.
That was a rough mom impression, but Durant's mother is fantastic. She's welcome at every NBA event of the year.
Yeah, and you know how KD always seems like just a little overwhelmed by everything? Like he's never totally comfortable. He's just always a little bit off. He's got a little nerd to him. Yeah, that was his thing with the trophy. Like he kept asking people like, do I put this here? Do I do this? Do I do that? Like he didn't quite know how to handle it, which I thought was very symbolic of like KD as a person and a player.
And that's also what makes his mom so great is KD's kind of awkward in those moments. And his mom is like right at home up there with the other five Warriors just chilling, giving everybody hugs, giving everybody high fives. She's the best.
Oh, totally. Because Katie's like, I did it, Mom. And she's like, yeah, you did. Yeah. You know, like she's much more comfortable. I do have some nitpicks about the celebration, though, and I think these are going to be a little bit more up your alley.
Okay. I'm going to get to the negative side at some point here.
Well, I think we should just do it right now.
Okay.
Not only did Katie not cry, and we predicted that months in advance. And I got a lot of messages from people saying, KD didn't cry, KD didn't cry. So we called that. But also, he didn't get hugged. Did you notice that as he's dribbling the ball out, this is his first title, he was the finals MVP, he was the lead guy, 39 points in the closeout win, none of his teammates went to hug him. I couldn't have been the only person who saw that. His first hug was LeBron James.
Yeah, well, that's... I didn't notice that specifically, but the whole scene kind of played weird to me. You know, it was just like it was KD's moment and he was sort of the center piece of the title celebration and he won finals MVP and it was the first interview from Doris Burke and everything else. But like it was strange to have Steph Curry kind of marginalized off to the side there and the whole scene was just a little bit odd. I don't know.
Well, let me add one more layer of oddness and weirdness to it. KD has his trophy. He has done his interview in quick reaction as the Bill Russell Finals MVP. They throw the microphone to Steph Curry, and the Oracle Arena crowd starts chanting loudly, MVP. They had chanted that for Durant, but not nearly as loudly or as passionately as for Curry. 2 minutes later. So Durant and his mom are standing on the podium, best moment of their basketball, you know, lives, basically. No question about it. And here's Curry is the one who's getting the attention and the true love from the fan base. I mean, that's undeniable. I'm not trying to be a jerk about this. That's
totally,
what happened.
Totally. It's just a strange dynamic. And I think we're headed for a strange couple of years in the NBA where everybody, the Warriors are clearly better than everybody else. But I'm not sure if people are going to feel that sort of kinship to them. I don't know. Like they have crossed over to a different category. I loved last year's team. I loved every success, kind of agonized over some of the setbacks. And this year, it just all feels a little bit more impersonal, which is fine because sometimes that's the way it works in sports. You're not going to love every team, and you're not going to find every team that interesting. But it should be noted that there's some of that at play here.
There definitely is. But can I do the super annoying thing, like the mansplaining thing, if you will, which is...
Mansplain to me? Go for it.
Yeah. There's the bigger takeaway to be drawn here.
Okay.
Is that KD and Steph, now more than ever, now that they've done it, now that KD has that trophy, now that they won the title, now that they both played well in that closeout game, I think they care less than ever about that dynamic, that Kobe-Shaq tension, that whose team is this stuff. I think that's less important than ever. I think we're all sort of setting this up in this false dichotomy situation where it's one or the other. This guy's more important than the other one. And you know they're playing chess here, which is like, no, if we can just get over that, we can kill everybody. And they took down LeBron James and Kyrie. I mean, I thought Kyrie was pretty sensational these last couple games. They took down that, arguably the best pairing of stars in, around the league on any other team. I think that would be fair to say. They took them down in five games. It wasn't easy, but it wasn't necessarily super difficult either.
Right.
And no, I think I'm not, they realize the force of their powers at this point. And that's the scariest part. And that's why my takeaway call from the finals game five was, okay, it's time to start talking dynasty for real right now. Because if these guys are going to be able to do it, if they can prove it, if they can get the monkey of last year off their back, if KD can play this well, if Steph's okay with it, if KD's on the podium calling him the big dog and praising all of his free throws and his rebounds and all of the little things that Curry did to make his life easier and also to welcome him into this organization with his unselfish leadership, what's breaking these guys up, man? This is going to roll for a while.
No question. And Steph is that type of superstar. Like, it was time to start talking dynasty in July because that's just the way the Warriors work. They are good at sharing the wealth and everyone can succeed. So let me say my piece here. I need to get a couple things off my chest. I mean, my issue has never been that they aren't going to be able to figure this out and find a way to make it work. It's just that it's not as entertaining. It's like the dream team can figure it out and guys sort of trade off possessions and trade off games where one takes over, but it's not that fun. And this has been a tough playoff run because I love basketball for like 200 different reasons. So I don't ever want to be Captain Negative on here, hating on people over and over again. Like, that's just not my thing. I'm not interested in it, whatever. But I'll reiterate that watching all this play out was not that entertaining. And I can't stand the people out here who are lecturing fans who don't love what's happened to the league. Like, this time last year, for instance, we came on after the finals and we were on the pod speaking in tongues, trying to make sense of like what just happened. Like both true, of our true. Brains were broken. I was talking shit about Skip Bayless. It was wild. And this year was just a step down from all that. And there were a lot of
that
fourth
was bound
quarters.
To happen, though.
Well, oh, totally, totally. That's fair. measuring every playoffs by last year's standard was bound to be disappointing. But there were a lot of fourth quarter Warrior blowouts this spring where it was tough not to wonder what might have happened had things gone a little differently. But having I want to give KD credit because you're right. He could not have been better. Like all things considered, every factor that was on the table, KD came out and murdered these finals. And he also looked at a landscape that LeBron had largely created, and he went and beat LeBron at his own game. Like, he played the chess game a little bit better than LeBron, and Golden State was its own power play, and it worked. Like, over the summer during free agency, I heard through the grapevine that he texted a different player before he decided and said, look, I'm getting a ring next year. No matter what happens, I'm getting a ring. And that's what happened. And he, like, his plan worked to perfection. And it may not be that fun or entertaining, but credit to him because he sort of like answered every criticism.
Okay, shameless plug alert. Go to read Lee Jenkins' story if you haven't, and be sure to note that part where he talks about the pressure he faces, Durant, in terms of trying to get that first title. His whole life revolved around it. Well, all of his inner circle is always talking to him about it. That's what he's being judged by. All the corporate interests in his life are expecting that from him. And he makes the comment that the only person who can relate to him on that level is LeBron James. And I think that really does show you this like mano a mano run that KD's been losing for just years and years and years. And I think people really got to get that point. And that's why I didn't necessarily hold his decision against him at the start. That's why I understand he kind of did it pragmatically. This was definitely the team that gave him the best chance to beat LeBron. That plan worked. I still want to go back to the enjoyment factor, though. Yeah. You had the light game. You had the light game five, man. That was a good game. Game four was pretty entertaining, too. I mean, this wasn't that bad of a finals.
I don't know. I think the smarter you are and the more you understand basketball, the less exciting it was. Like an email from a friend this morning actually kind of explained it pretty well. He said, last night was a pretty good microcosm of the series. It felt like Cleveland sort of had a fake chance the whole time, but never enough of one to be genuinely exciting. And that's how I felt about it.
Yeah, what about the individual brilliance, though? I mean, this style of play where at times in that game, all 10 guys on the court are 6'7 or shorter. That's crazy.
Yes.
And you have the situation where individual talents, Kyrie Irving, LeBron James, even throwing Klay Thompson, he didn't play great in Game 5, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant. I mean, these guys are making unbelievable one-on-one plays, hitting huge shots, going back and forth. Yes, it's not buzzer beater, you know, super tense like that, but the tension in the building was very real because of the specter of last season. I mean, there's no doubt about that played a huge role. If last season had never happened, I think this entire finals would have been experienced differently. There would have been even less drama because you're like, you would have just assumed that they're invincible because their talent would overwhelm. But I had serious doubts the whole way. I mean, every time KD is hitting a shot as an answer to something that LeBron's doing, you know, those crazy just bull rush layups that he's making. Every time KD had a response to that, part of me was like, wow, I did not expect that. I thought he was going to fold. I thought this team was going to fold because they did last year and because KD had never done it before. And to me, that made it for a very compelling series.
Yeah. I don't know if it made it very compelling as a series, but again, and I said earlier, like, KD answered every criticism. I don't know if there were that many criticisms to answer about his game, but it was the way he won these finals that was impressive. And that was the thing that caught me off guard. I don't know what his averages were for the series, but it had to be like close to 35 a game in most of these games. And so he was great, and it was cool to watch that. My only point this entire time is that it would have been much cooler to see Steph come back and win by himself and with the rest of the Warriors. Or, like, you got to admit, watching KD win with Russ or win on his own with a different team would have been so fucking cool. And last night wasn't that.
I hear you, and I mean this in the most respectful way possible. You're thinking backwards, bro. Like, the future's here. The future's here. These guys did it together. They're on the same page. They are aligned. And when you start looking at all the key factors that determine a dynasty, age, that's not an issue right now. It's not going to be an issue for 2 years to me. Yeah. Ownership. These guys have the money. As Mike Brown said last night after the game, money is not an object to these guys. They're going to have a new stadium soon. You should have seen the line out the door at the team store selling the championship merchandise last night. After the game, you look at egos, chemistry. I mean, a guy like Klay Thompson chases Kyrie Irving around thanklessly for 5 games, doesn't get nearly as many shots or as much attention as he did last year, and he's still on the press conference podium giggling at every single word Draymond Green said. Look at Draymond Green. He didn't even play that well. You know, I mean, he was talking a lot. We opened with his kind of silly trash talk for Ohio. Imagine what he would have said if he had played well. Like, you know, really. I mean, he could be better. And so
also,
you look at all the different.
Hold on. Yeah. Also, imagine a scenario where Klay and Draymond have to play well and have to be great for the Warriors to win. Isn't that a better alternative? I mean, Klay was amazing on defense, but both of those guys were kind of hit or miss on the other end.
Look, I get that it's jarring. I get that you want to go back a year. It's done, man. These guys are here. And I'm telling you, and we got to look forward and say, how does this get screwed up? If it's not the ownership, it's definitely not going to be management. Their management's excellent.
Yeah.
I think the coaching part is a question mark. You know, what happens with Kerr? But these guys showed that they can kill it with Mike Brown, so it's not a huge question mark. You look at the stars' chemistry. You look at their depth. And you just even look at like what LeBron James is saying. I mean, his post-game press conference is like, look, I don't know. I don't know what our answer is as Cleveland to Golden State. I don't know how we get onto their level. And he's basically saying, look, everybody around the league is going to be making moves to try to keep up with these guys. They've now set the bar to a different level. And I think he's exactly right. And it goes back to one discussion we had like a year ago in terms of the stranded stars. It's not just the DeMarcus Cousins and the Anthony Davises who look stranded now. Basically, you look stranded. If you're not on a team that has three stars, you look stranded, right? And throw Paul George in that conversation, Gordon Hayward, even guys like Damian Lillard in Portland. I don't think he's going anywhere. I'm not necessarily saying any of those guys are going somewhere else. But all of those people now have to view their own futures through this Warriors lens of like, if you want to have a chance, do you have to team up?
And it will be really interesting to see where things go from here, you know, and how things shake out this summer. And I'm excited because I'm sick of sort of like litigating the Warriors and Durant and everything else. Like the rest of the NBA is more fun to me. And as of last night, we're now in off-season mode. Like we're in draft mode. I was on a conference call with John Calipari this morning. Like,
oh,
this is great.
Name drop.
Like, I'm ready.
Name drop.
I'm ready. But it's less about thinking backwards and more about acknowledging that this is all kind of bizarre.
Well, can I tell you one person who co-signs you, though?
Who?
For sure. LeBron James.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I don't know if you caught some of his little digs. Now, he did not really come out forcefully, right?
Uh-huh.
But a couple days ago, he said at a press conference that what the Warriors had done was different than what he had done because they had to build something from the ground up in Miami, whereas the Warriors had already built it and KD joined. Then he used the word recruiting last summer to kind of talk about how they went after and added Durant. Then he kept kind of playing on the idea of he has never played for a super team. I don't know if you saw his comments about that, but LeBron said he had never played for a super team before and throughout his entire career.
Yeah.
and sort of in the same breath as he's kind of praising this Golden State
monster. I gave that one the chin scratching emoji.
Oh, for sure. And then on top of all of that, how many times did LeBron praise KD this series versus how many times did he praise Steph Curry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Time after time after time, LeBron is giving all the praise to KD. And maybe it's just because he's not asked the questions. Possible. I'm not sure. I mean, there was a lot of focus on their individual rivalry from the media throughout this series. But the amount of tension that he gave to KD and sort of putting this title sort of on KD and the acquisition of KD rather than everything else that's sort of around that organization, to me, it sort of read between the lines. And LeBron hinted that at some point in the future, his true thoughts on all of this could come out. I think LeBron's true thoughts are actually your thoughts. That's what I think.
maybe. And as far as the LeBron KD phrase is concerned and the lack of Steph phrase, I think there are a number of factors in play there. Because number one, we've been over it. The rest of the league's superstars just have like a really strange relationship to Steph Curry and a resentment that isn't entirely rational. But I will say it was interesting watching the Cavs over the last five games because stopping Steph was the defense's priority every game. And they like that was job number one, and that's one of the reasons KD could go off the way he did. It was because Steph was getting trapped off of every pick and roll, and he was getting pushed around, and that was their goal. And it should have been, because that's how you beat the Warriors, is like they become mortal if you take away Steph. And then the other thing, and the other reason he was mentioning Durant over and over and over again, is to remind people that this was like a whole different deal. And that, like, the deck had been stacked over the summer, and everyone should remember that when they discuss what was or wasn't happening in this series.
Yeah, that's a good point. That is a nice defense mechanism by LeBron in the legacy talk, right? He's like, yes, I fell to 3-5, but come on. Like, look at these guys over here. Like, don't hold this against me when you're doing the Jordan comparisons, right?
Yeah, well, LeBron is smart. Like, he doesn't do anything by accident. That's my only point with that. And but the Steph stuff remains super weird and hard to explain.
Yeah, I guess... Let me ask you this, because I was kind of hyping the dynasty stuff here on this podcast. I mean, how long do you think it can last before KD and Steph just either get sick of each other or just decide to go do their own things? Because that's kind of the fundamental question here. Like, I'm not going to go all the way, you know, Jeff Van Gundy and say, like, oh, this is the greatest duo in NBA history, but this is a really, really, really good duo. We saw they can play at a 10, both of them, offensively, at the same time in the same finals. We saw how seamlessly they work together. Like you're mentioning, Steph's getting trapped. KD's the release valve. You know, KD's doing something. Now Steph can move off the ball, get some easier shots. They can share the burden. They can cover for any weaknesses that Steph might have defensively. They can conserve their energy. I mean, this thing really works. So how long until they decide, all right, we're good. Let's try to do something else, right? Because we did have this feeling in like 2011, right, when the Heatles assembled. It was like, this is going to go on for 8 years. Remember, they had that parade and they were like 5, 6, 7, 8. And they wound up, with 2. I mean, are we headed for a same thing where like it seems more glorious right now in this moment than it will be?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, that's my first reaction, is that it never lasts as long as you expect it to. Whether it's health issues with one of those two, or it's other teams emerge. Like, who knows what happens if LeBron and CP3 and Kawhi are playing together in San Antonio in a year. Like, who knows? But I will say that watching all this, like, I'm kind of looking ahead to 2020 as the next possible time a different team wins. And I also think my other two responses to that are that, number one, KD and Steph will be playing for that place in history as the greatest duo or whatever, and that will become the motivation going forward, is that they are now trying to just sort of win as many titles as possible, and that's the way that they will circumvent some of the people saying that this title or that title don't mean as much. And like, if you win 5 or 6, nobody can say a word. So I think that becomes the goal. My objection to all the duo talk is only that it doesn't give enough credit to Klay and Draymond. Like, this is more of a, what's the word? Is it quatrain? for four? I don't know. But like,
wow.
All four of those guys are perfect. Like, they fit perfectly together. Like, Klay, you couldn't design a better sidekick for Steph and Durant. And then Draymond is a freak of nature in terms of his defensive intelligence, his timing, the way the physicality that he gets away with consistently, which is like its own skill. So I don't like, yes, Steph and KD are unbelievable, but it's also, this is a whole different level of monster than like Shaq and Kobe.
For sure. I mean, there's a parallelogram at play here. There's no question. But look, if you even take one of those guys out, though, I mean, let's run that out. Let's take Klay out of the equation in 2 years. They decide, hey, we got to trade him. We got to just kind of balance our books a little bit. They determine he's the most expendable.
And that's a real thing that could happen. Like, that people have been sort of like debunking the Klay rumors. I could totally see the Warriors looking at all this in a year and saying, you know what, let's sell high and try to get back as many pieces as possible so that we can extend this run.
Yeah, so, but even if that happens, you can still go back to that duo, right? I mean, that's kind of the strength of that group. When you have two of the best three players in the league, all the other pieces are still, while very valuable, even as valuable all-NBA caliber players like you're mentioning, are still kind of assets, you know, around that combination. And that is really scary. And I think it's going to go on here for a while. Just for some context, I mean, I think the best modern dynasty in terms of like how much they won in a short period of time is Bulls 6 titles in 8 years, right?
Right.
That's in play for Golden State. You know, they've got 2 and 3 already. I mean, the math is still there. If you look at Steph and KD, they could both reach 6 titles to match Jordan by age 33. Jordan didn't get there until he turned 35. So they've got a little buffer, a little wiggle room there. I'm not predicting it. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying there is a track here where they could get there. And even if they win 2 of the next 4, that seems pretty conservative right now, right? Let's say they win 2 of the next 4 after this one. That puts them above Showtime Lakers. That puts them above kind of any period of the Spurs. It puts them above the Shaq Kobe Lakers or any other team besides the 1990s Bulls in terms of the modern era dynasty teams in terms of how many titles they won in a short period of time. So this is very real. And you mentioned the dynasty talk, you know, began last July. I mean, I think that's true. Maybe it began when they won the 73rd game, you know, because that kind of elevates them to a different discussion too. But this is where it got real now. Now is like we really have to be thinking about these things because the numbers, the wins, the titles, the accolades, everything is adding up to the point here. And the path is so clean and clear going forward that there's a very real chance here in a couple of years we're talking about the Warriors as the best team besides the 1990s Bulls in the three-point era. The best organization, the best winning, everything.
Absolutely, man. Of course. And I mean, that's been on the table. That's at least that's been on my mind for several months now. And it's one of the things, if you can allow me a couple more minutes to be negative, I have two more points I want to hit. Number one, all of this, if this were just a self-contained season, it would be totally fine. Part of what bugs me is that I'm dreading a future where every spring involves various think pieces and dumb arguments about competitive balance and everything else. And remembering that, like, had KD gone to one other place, we would have had just like a golden era. However, I'm not gonna dwell on that. I do want to talk about that Nike commercial. Did you see the Durant Nike commercial?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen it. So you're gonna have to give me the lowdown. I got the email blast on it, which is always a little scary. I mean, it's not necessarily a good sign when they're blasting out the PR emails about the commercial within seconds of the title being over. So they had itchy trigger fingers. But lay it out for me.
Okay, so right after the game went final, ABC went to commercial while they set up the championship podium and whatnot, and Nike went live with a 60-second Durant commercial that basically featured an ODB song in the background, which was great, and some Durant highlights from Seattle, OKC, and it had like a round table of critics throwing out various criticisms that he's faced over the years, I guess. I don't really know. And then they end with like the crescendo with people hating on the Warriors' decision and calling him soft and calling him a crybaby and a cupcake and everything else. And then it cuts to him winning the title and it says, "Debate this." And it was cool.
That must have hurt.
Not really. Like, I just thought it wasn't that great. I really did. And I love almost any Nike commercial. And I pine for the golden era of Nike commercials. Like, the late 90s, Nike was really on top of their shit with, like, Tiger Woods commercials, Ken Griffey commercials, Jordan commercials. It was great. Shout out to Whedon and Kennedy. But this was kind of lame. And first of all, I thought it was dumb to make the haters part of the conversation at that moment, just in sort of like on principle. And Dan Steinberg wrote about that today. Like, if John Wall ever wins a title, I'll be so depressed if the first commercial is about it, like, involves Colin Coward in any respect. But more importantly, I just thought it was intellectually dishonest to pretend that Durant has had haters or doubters every step of the way. Like, are we really going to do that after this title? I mean, Katie silencing like the critics. I mean, I can't think of a player who was more beloved for the last 9 years. And the only thing that people haven't reacted well to is is the Golden State stuff, and at no point has anybody doubted his talent because of that. They just thought it was kind of whack to go to a team that was that loaded already.
Well, look, I know how I'm going to spend these next couple of days. I was planning to unplug a little bit. Nope, not going to unplug. I'm going home. I'm getting in the lab. I'm going to do a super cut of this commercial with you and your statements from this podcast spliced in as the hater. We're gonna pan to this panel of critics, and there's gonna all of a sudden be a voice. KD's just a role player. And then we're gonna have another one of, oh, he ruined the NBA. I mean, we've got hours of material here from things that you've said. So
that's a totally fair response. Well, it really is.
Here's the thing though. I was having a hard time separating the point that you made, which I think was a strong point, from the fact that you're the one who's making it, because you have been harder on KD, I think, over these last couple of months than most people. But I'm going to pull it out and say you are right because of this. In his post-game press conference, when he's drunk off beer for his first beer since February, and you know he's got the loose lips and kind of pouring his heart out,
right,
Kevin Durant tells the media, quote, "Proving haters wrong, like, that's cool. That's cool for me to talk about on Instagram or Twitter, but like, you don't concern me. I'm coming in and working every day, seeing how I can be the best teammate I can be, the best player I can be. You can talk about whatever you want to talk about, but nobody comes in and cares about the game or loves the game as much as I do or works as hard as I do at the basketball game." I think there is, and this is something that a lot of writers have kind of said over the years, there's a certain insecurity to Kevin Durant. Like, he reads all this stuff. He does listen to it.
Totally.
The haters do get to him. But you're right. His driving force of his life, of his career, you know, going all the way back to when he was sleeping in the gym in middle school, you know, those famous stories about him, is not proving negativity wrong.
And there just hasn't been that much negativity.
Yeah.
Like, I don't look at his career and think of all the criticism that he's faced.
But even if there was, like, even if you were, you know, on ESPN all day long with these takes, right, or FS1, and like, you were just blaring at him, if you were the Skip Bayless for Kevin Durant, right? That's not what's getting him up in the morning. I really don't think it is. I think this dude just loves basketball. He wants to hoop, period. You know,
like, totally. And that's why I've always liked him.
Yeah, and the Rucker Park stuff in terms of, you know, that big shot in game three that he hit, you know, just kind of the cold-blooded assassin nature to some of his three-pointers in game five as well. To me, that's not like, and I was joking, like, he's staring down Rihanna, right? Like, that's not really who KD is. I mean, he kind of came off almost a little bit awkward when he was doing that, right? I mean, he's out there just playing because he loves basketball. He's really good at it. That's the driving force of his life. That's why I think he fits in Golden State. I don't know if he's like, you know, team joy, like Steve Kerr, you know, going over the top with how much he loves life and wants to be effervescent all the time. But he fits in with this group of guys who all they want to do is ball and have a good time.
Yeah. Well, and whether it's the supervillains thing or KD silencing haters that were never really there, I don't know. There was just something mechanical about the way a lot of this played out, including whether it's reactions from the media or Nike or whatever. The whole thing just struck me as a little contrived.
No, it wasn't. But it wasn't the right note to hit. You're 100% correct.
Yeah.
Don't go to the haters route. Go to the joy route. Show him crying with his mother or whatever scene you've got, you know, from past finals. I mean, I think that's the way to play it. Not the sort of negativity thing. Real quick on that, though. Is there anything less intimidating than Steve Kerr in a supervillains t-shirt?
No, and that was actually my next question. I have a couple notes here, and then we can get into it. We can finish up with like 20 minutes of mailbag questions. But my next question was going to be about Kerr. I loved seeing him in the supervillains shirt because it's so not intimidating that it was kind of hilarious. But do you think he's coaching the Warriors next year?
Man, I do not know.
Okay.
He seemed so happy after that title. He honestly might have been the happiest person, mm-hmm. him or KD. but or actually maybe David West too. David West was really happy, as you might imagine. And I was a little worried there for a while. David West was going to have to spend the last 27 minutes of his first title after 15 years in the league in the locker room because of that stare down with Tristan yeah. Thompson. That had me real nervous for him. Like, that's not the way you want it to end.
I honestly wondered about that. Like, did the refs take that into account? Like, look, this guy has left a lot of money on the table over the last 2 years. Let's just let him sit over there on the bench and enjoy this.
Yeah, so Kerr's excitement, I guess, could be read as triumph through adversity, or it could be read as like, well, I got this one, you know, now I can kind of move on, right? I think you can read it both ways. It's like that could have been the last chapter for him right now, or it could have been, you know, the mountaintop. And I don't know really how to read it. I mean, I guess my nature would be to assume that he's going to try to stick around and keep going because they've got such a good thing going. Because it's not like he has to be there 82 games. You know, it's not like they have to take next year's regular season seriously. It's a lot of the same things we say about LeBron in terms of managing the season. Like, you can even say that about their coaching staff right now, right?
Totally.
And I think even if he was like a glorified Steve Nash consultant role, where like he's still the head coach, but like really on a day-to-day basis, he's just kind of there to chip in his thoughts every once in a while, pull people who are out of line into line. I mean, I think that would add value. So if you're Golden State, you'd want to have him around. So my guess is he will be around in some capacity with the official title head coach next season. But I don't think it's a guarantee.
Yeah, that's a good guess. That's maybe they'll come up with a plan of some sort to try to ease the burden on him. My official line, and maybe the official line of this podcast, has always been that, like, Steve Kerr, you are awesome. You don't need to bother with this and go do something cool that doesn't put you through like crazy amounts of stress. Because he would have so many different options if he decided not to coach next year. And he could just leave the angry Warriors World comments behind and enjoy his life. But either way, I was really happy for him because he last year's finals had to stink because he did make some real questionable decisions. And I'm glad he got to be there for that.
Oh yeah, and you know he was beating himself up all of last year too about those decisions. I mean, I'm sure he's his own worst critic, and like for everything that we joke about, oh Festus, like what's Varejao doing? You know, deep in Kerr's mind, I mean, he has this sort of philosophical approach. It's different than Phil Jackson, but I think it's equally as committed. Like he believes every person matters, like fundamentally to his core. He does not want to just ride his star players. And that's why he still got Zaza starting the second half last night, even though Zaza is just hopeless in that game.
Totally.
It's tough when your philosophy gets tested like that, right? And so for him to come back, I thought was great. And last thought real quick on the Supervillains t-shirt. I thought they needed that, right? I mean, all the talk about 3-1, coming back, you know, LeBron showing up in all black for the practice just like he did last year. They're trying to recreate it. They're trying to build momentum. Like, there was never really that much momentum for Cleveland, if you think about it. Like, when you deal a team its first loss in 61 days, that's not a momentum reverser, right?
That's why I don't know how much they needed of anything. They had four borderline Hall of Famers.
Yeah, no, I feel you. But they just need a little levity, I guess, is what I'm saying. It's not like they needed this, like, Newt Rockne speech to be like, hey, guys, we can still do it. It's just like, you know, throw on a funny T-shirt, lighten the mood. Remind everybody that, you know, you have this amazing collection of talent, and as long as you take care of business, you're going to win. I think that's really what they needed before game five, and that's what Kerr gave, and I think full credit to him for that.
Okay. Two more notes. Very quickly, Kevin Love, is he on the Cavs next year?
To me, he's a piece they've got to move. I'm all in on Kevin Love for Paul George. I think that's the move. They have to have somebody who can guard KD. They have to have somebody.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of a no-brainer. I don't think that trade is going to be on the table.
Why not? Why not? Why not?
Because it's just not. Like the internet can't necessarily will this into existence. Like,
Let's do it.
It doesn't really make sense for Indiana. And I would be shocked if that actually came to fruition. But I think you move Love regardless. Like the Kevin Love resurgence in these finals felt sort of overplayed to me. Like, I think he wasn't getting played off the court entirely, but there's a difference between being capable and competent and being actually good and like changing the dynamics of the series. and Love was never in that second category. And he came back last night and they went on that huge run. And I'm just kind of sick of the same Kevin Love story every time they play the Warriors. And I think if I were LeBron James, to put myself in his shoes, I would be sick of it too. And so I don't know. I think you move him for whatever you can get, but I'm not sure if they would do that if they can't get like a superstar back.
Well, that's what I'm saying, is you can't just move him for the sake of moving him. I mean, you have to have a targeted addition. And
Well, what about if Avery Bradley and Jay Crowder were available? I doubt Boston would want to do that, but if they were.
Yeah, I would do that. Just because of matchups. I mean, their clearest number one priority is they have to have an elite defensive option to put on KD. They just have to do it, no matter what. Their only real great trade piece is Kevin Love. I don't think you can get anything great for Tristan Thompson or any of their other bench guys, role players, whatever. I mean, I think besides the Kevin Love factor, they're going to need to do some retooling on that bench too. I mean, they really came up empty in Game 5. A lot of those guys gave them nothing. At some point, I was tracking whether Andre Iguodala would finish with more points, rebounds, and assists than Cleveland's entire bench combined. Newsflash, that's a bad sign when your sixth man is better than the team's entire bench. But I do think now is the time to liquidate Love. I think he's got some really good value. He played well. He's shown defensive improvement. He's got a lot of experience. He's a name that you can sell. I mean, he's very, you know, now that he's played on the stage with LeBron.
He's in the best shape of his career. He's great. He's just half as valuable against the Warriors. And for most teams, that won't matter. But for the Cavs, it does.
And that's why I think you shouldn't sleep on this Paul George stuff, man. I think that has a chance. If I'm Indiana and my options are go young and really retool it and understand that you could slip into this, you know, Orlando mold or Detroit
that's
mold.
True.
Or you can have a legitimate face of the franchise, guy who's going to sell some tickets and some jerseys and keep you propped up in that sort of 6-8 range in the Eastern Conference playoff picture. I mean, you're not having great choices if you're the Pacers, right? Like, you're already stuck because Paul George has put you behind the eight ball because the game changed so rapidly you couldn't keep up with it. There are no great choices for Indiana. That's why I think it could be worse. But we'll see. You're right. I am trying to will it into existence, by the way, because...
It would make next year's finals a lot more fun if Paul George were playing in Kevin Love's spot.
Oh, no doubt, because we
can all agree on that.
Oh, 100%, and it would make our jobs easier too, because every single week we get questions, what player can you add to these teams to like make it more even, right? And like, well,
yeah.
I mean, this is the level of player you have to talk about to say, okay, Cleveland's now on the same level. And even if they did add Paul George for Kevin Love, I'm not sure they're on Golden State's level yet, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Final note. Before we take questions, I want to talk about Lee Jenkins's story. There was a section in there that it kind of explains everything now. And it says, Rich Kleiman, Wale's former manager, so he's got some DC roots. Rich Kleiman had a backstage pass and Jay-Z wanted to meet the Slim Sensation. Durant shyly declined. First of all, I can't believe Jay-Z wanted to meet him and Durant wouldn't. But he's grown so much since then, Kleiman says. Durant has become both baller and seeker. He quizzes the chef at Tosca Cafe about ingredients, but he's not a foodie. He flies a drone over his home,
but
he's not a techie. Now we know where your bond with KD originates. He's a drone guy, man.
The greatest part about that is Lee told me that nugget. So Lee, for the entire week... actually the last 10 days of the finals, he was just dropping these little anecdotes on me at various points.
Right. That's the best part about hanging out with Lee Jenkins, is he knows like every secret in the NBA.
Yeah, and he also knows that it's complete catnip for me, so he's just kind of doing it to mess with me, I think, sometimes a little bit too. It's like, oh, you really are interested in KD. Well, let me give you this little nugget here. You can chew on this for the next day, you know, like little morsels, like day by day. So he gives me that drone nugget. And I got really defensive, Andrew. I was like, don't knock it, okay? Don't try to paint him like a dork, Lee. You got to try it. Aerial photography is the new wave. Like, don't say this is... don't try to paint this in a weird light like he's some sort of a nerd. This is awesome. And then he was like, no, I wasn't even trying to say that. I was just giving you some information.
Yeah, great. Aerial photography is the new wave. All right, a couple questions here. It's that I have enjoyed along the way. And we'll finish up in the next 20 minutes. Thomas, midway through the finals, said, you know the finals are a dud when multiple sites are posting about a KD and Bron secret mixtape from the 2010 lockout. Hashtag wake me up in 2020. He said that like after game two, I think. And credit to Cleveland for making it fun since then. So that is more an indication of how depressed we were halfway through the finals. It got more interesting.
Well, look, but I was going to say LeBron is still clearly the GOAT on the court. I think that this, you know, averaging the triple-double in the finals is a good example of that. KD got him on that track, though, man. I don't think it was close.
I honestly did not have the heart to listen to that track.
Smart.
Because I feel like it would have made me sad for both of them. And I recorded some rap music when I was in college years old. Like, that would honestly make me like, I don't know. It would not be great.
What was your rap name?
We're not going to get into it. Really not going to get into
it. Well, look, you know how people are always like, LeBron has no flaws, though? Like, that's sort of, his flow is a flaw, like, for sure.
Okay, we found a flaw. Found a blind spot in LeBron's game. All right, so Barack asks, to Sharp's point about the pressure Steph puts on a defense, it reminds me of Randy Moss. Steph's shooting is like Moss's speed. It stretches the offense to the point where there is so much more room for Kevin Durant, a.k.a. Wes Welker, to operate. This is why Steph is more valuable to the Warriors than Durant, even though Durant might be better on his own. All right. First of all,
Wes
comparing
Welker.
KD to Wes Welker is pretty rough. I really loved it.
Come on.
It's consistent with the role player theory. But first of all, yes, Steph is definitely more valuable. The Warriors just become a lot more vulnerable when Steph is not going off. But I think this question and this analogy actually hits on what makes Golden State so unstoppable. And it's that, like, it's kind of like the Patriots if they had two Randy Mosses. Like, Steph stretches the defense, and then instead of Wes Welker going over the middle, Kevin Durant is another Randy Moss going over the middle. And it just becomes impossible.
Yeah, Kevin Durant's just a scrappy, undersized worker.
Well, Kevin Durant actually does kind of remind me of Randy Moss, so it works. Yeah. And then obviously, like, I think Draymond is probably Gronk in that analogy. But that's how I understand the Warriors, is that they have so many different threats that are just way too much for a defense to handle, that it sort of is, it's only a matter of time until they break your heart.
Yeah, one thing I'd say about Steph's impact, and, you know, people call this like gravity or you know, how he pulls the defense towards him, is that the finals, when Cleveland's locked in defensively and really playing hard, the finals is a great reminder that some teams just have no hope ever of taking Steph away. You know what I mean? Like, early in the regular season, or even some of these other playoff matchups, like, the opposing defenses aren't even good enough to try to take Steph away, even if they throw multiple guys at him, even if they completely schemed around him. They just don't have enough good pieces, enough discipline, enough experience to do it. And so I think, you know, Steph's value as this sort of setup guy, this, you know, kind of like non-ball handling creator, if you want to call it that, where, like, he's not doing it because he's got the ball in his hands, he's doing it just because he's on the court, is never more apparent than when they're playing an elite defense that is capable of making his life difficult, but also has to consume so much energy doing that. So for sure, it shows through in the plus minus. I mean, people have noted that for years. It showed through in the plus minus during this finals. I believe Steph had the highest raw plus minus, according to John Schumann of NBA.com. I saw this today, of the last 20 finals, maybe even the last 20 playoff series, but fact check that part. Bottom line, when Steph's on the court, Golden State badly outscores the opposition consistently for 3 years now. And he's never more valuable than when you're playing an elite defense.
And we don't have to get into it now, but I'm fascinated to see where the Steph discussion goes over the next few years, because this year it sort of felt like he was an afterthought, and that's understandable in part because this was KD's first ring. KD kind of was the story of the year. But I think as we go forward, people are going to start to realize how critical Steph is as sort of the linchpin that allows everything else to work. Or they won't, and that'll be weird too. And who knows? But next question from Bo. He says, maybe I'm the only person who cares about this, but Warriors fans chanting Warriors with the inflection of hockey fans heckling an opposing goalie really bothers me. Am I crazy? So, Ben, you were there. What do you think of the Warriors chant?
They've been doing that for a long time, so it doesn't necessarily bother me. Look, I think the takeaway from the fan base side of this should be, imagine your team blowing a 3-1 lead. Like, we know in our, like, intellectually what that meant when that happened, but imagine if your, like, whole life, soul, everything was poured into the Warriors, and a lot of these fans that I met, either at the Warriors World event or anywhere else, were fans of a terrible, terrible organization for years. Like, not quite Clippers bad, but really bad. You finally reach the summit. You think you're going to have this dynasty that's going to continue forever, and then you just get it completely ripped away from you last year. I think that kind of gives you a pass. Like, not only with the Twitter trash talk, but all sorts of reckless behavior. You know, I think you can have a crazy parade. I think Draymond can lead the trash talk. Like I said, I think he's going to be completely unchained when it comes time to celebrate this one, and he should be.
Yeah,
and they should.
You're right. The Warriors. This is why I will never be mad at the Warriors or their fans, is because they are sort of the West Coast version of the Wizards. Like, the Clippers were famously awful, and that was kind of a badge of honor for a long time. Whereas the Warriors were just quietly mismanaged and shitty, and that's what the Wizards have been. And so their fans still have a sense of humor and. So I enjoy it. As far as the chant itself, though, I had two responses to this. Number one, the first time I ever like went to a sporting event or remembered it was like it was a Caps playoff game, and it was the Caps versus the Penguins, and all of the Caps fans were taunting the Pittsburgh goalie Tom Barrasso, and they were spent like the third period chanting Barrasshole. And I was like 7 years old and was just like, oh my God, sports are the coolest. I can't wait to do this for the rest of my life. so I support hockey heckling. The Warriors chant is already starting to get annoying, though. And that's how you know the dynasty is getting real. It's like we don't like it now, and it's going to be so obnoxious like 3 years from now, like the Zombie Nation thing in Miami.
You know what will really bother Bo to find out is that deep in the bowels of Oracle Arena, there's a giant wall as you come in from the loading dock, and on the wall, they have spelled out Warriors with like 17 R's, so it's like to mimic that chant. So as you're walking along, it's just like 60-foot-long spread out word in giant yellow letters of Warriors. Like, as you're walking down the hallway, that would probably drive this guy crazy.
Yeah, I'm sure. Next question from Raina. She says, what KD never got in Westbrook, he found in Steph. I don't think anything KD said during his podium interview was an intentional rebuke of Russ, but he made it very clear that what he's found in Golden State, a partner in crime, a supportive home all around, is exactly what he wasn't getting in OKC, particularly with Westbrook. What do you think about that?
Who went to the Hamptons? Steph went to the Hamptons, not Russ.
Not Russ. Yeah. Not Russ. That's all you need to say.
I think that that might be as simple as it gets. I mean, I think when you're looking at just sort of situationally, personality-wise, I was kind of wondering about how KD would fit in the Bay Area. Do you remember the first days he started getting there, where he was like going to every rap concert, and all of a sudden he had this crazy tattoo that like covered his entire leg, and he shows up at USA practice and he's like a different guy, and it's like, uh-oh, did like this guy just get released from like the after-school program and fall in with the wrong crowd? Like, I was a little bit nervous for like how that was going to play out.
That's a great old man reaction from you. Love it.
Well, yeah, you watch a guy for 10 years and you just want the best for him. That's all I'm going to say. But I was a little nervous how this was going to play out. But ultimately, it goes back to what we were saying earlier about negativity versus positivity. I think KD is a positive guy. I think that's what he thrives on. I think that Westbrook is much more in the mold of Kobe Bryant, hate, Muse Cage stuff. And I think that sometimes those polar opposites could really drive Oklahoma City to great success. And I think sometimes that can really backfire and just not kind of work. And as they've developed over the course of this year, like Katie spoke for a pretty good amount of time last night about Curry's leadership style, how they would do shooting contests with each other, how they push each other. You know, he was kind of joking that he has better numbers in their pregame shooting routines than Curry does, because obviously they track this kind of stuff because they're both, you know, big time true shooting percentage efficiency nerds. I think that he did find a chemistry there, and I didn't necessarily know that was going to stick, to be honest. You know, I kind of wondered coming into the season, and even at times in the middle of this season, whether they were the same personality type of guys, same, you know, approach to basketball type of guys. They both like to have the ball. They're both really good with the ball. They both are kind of alpha guys. Could there be some butting of heads? And instead, it just didn't play out that way. And the Westbrook stuff, I actually believe now that KD's won the Finals MVP and won the title. Like, I think that KD can actually be past the Westbrook stuff, don't you?
Oh, definitely. He should be. I didn't think he was past the Westbrook stuff the whole time. But
really? Because I thought, like, if they lost the title, or, like, you know, the worst case scenario that we talked about, where, like, KD's the big loser of the finals, right? Don't you think all that stuff just haunts him? And he's like, oh my God, like, what did I do? Why did I leave this guy? Like, why did I put myself out here like this? Like, I felt like that was going to hang over his decision.
No, I think he was leaving. I think he was leaving Russ regardless. He may have come to regret, like, Golden State in a worst case scenario, but I think he wanted to play on his own. And it makes sense for all the reasons you mentioned. Like, he was just sort of in a different mode. And it was pretty poetic to see him win Finals MVP a week before Russ wins his regular season MVP.
Oh, dear.
Well, it's like we live in this, I don't know, I think we're past it, but maybe 5 years ago or 6 or 7 years ago, we were in like the peak of the hot take generation, and like something like that would have been beaten into the ground. So we don't need to beat it into the ground. We don't need to, like, write some Woj-style column about how it's a metaphor for everything and their souls and whatnot. But it was pretty interesting that that's the way it's going to play out.
Yeah, that is actually, I mean, I hadn't thought about that, but it is going to be pretty awkward if Westbrook gets his MVP award. Not like he was stat chasing the whole time, but there was some, you know, assisting going on with his rebounds. And then, you know, you have this other team over here where it's like selflessness and, you know, it's like yoga and like,
like just light years more successful. So
it's like,
I don't know.
Cool mid-40s win. See you next year. It's like, yeah, okay.
I appreciate them both. I really do. Jonathan in DC says, talking about the best small forwards of all time, Ben mentioned he thinks it's LeBron and KD alone at the top of the mountain as the best at that position. What about Larry Bird? How do either of you think he would line up with KD?
Yeah, no, I said that Durant would most likely kind of conclude this era as the number two small forward of all time behind LeBron. He's still got some work to do. I mean, when you're just looking at like accumulation of MVPs, titles and so forth, I think he's still probably, you know, a solid 2 years away from passing Bird on that list. So I go LeBron 1, Bird 2, KD 3 right now. But
yeah,
KD's coming fast. I mean, I think the nature of this finals victory, the nature of his performance, the fact that he's going to be right back in the MVP conversation again next year, you know, even if, you know, they're not trying to like force feed him, they're still trying to keep minutes off him, all that stuff, he's going to be in that conversation. And also the longevity factor. I mean, that's always going to hold Bird back in these conversations because, you know, like I think we mentioned last week, there's a chance KD passes Jordan on the all-time scoring list. Like, he's been scoring so many points for so long, and he's still so young that he's most likely going to retire as a top five scorer. That's just something that Bird can't match up with. So we're still not quite there yet in terms of KD passing Bird, but this week was a big step forward, and there's not that many more steps to go.
Yeah, I think it's worth mentioning just to say that obviously if you put KD in the middle of the 80s, he would be a fucking problem for everybody. So that's not how to do these historical discussions. And I think a lot of arguments I've had have mentioned that, like, you know, throw KD in the 90s and like Jordan couldn't do anything with him. And like some of that's true. But at the same time, Larry Bird's like career was so impressive at the time that you have to balance that too. But I think you're right. KD will get there if he wins like three more rings.
The all-time,
which is completely on the table.
The all-time player for that, though, is Shaq. Like, can you imagine Shaq in 1947?
or now. There are a couple players who would be problems no matter what. Like, put Wilt in 2017, and Wilt would be an issue.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think he would be, but I don't know if he'd be 100-point Wilt or 50 points per game Wilt.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. All right, a couple more here. Kotz asks, how much did player development go into the minutes Patrick McCaw got in Game 5? Are the Warriors that confident, or is his defense actually that good? Just real quick, my reaction to this was like, I saw some Warriors fans saying that this is a product of the system and a testament to the management that they have in Golden State. And that's true to a point, but it should also be pointed out that like you could throw almost anyone out there with Draymond, Steph, and Durant, and like they would find a way to make it work. Like if you put Kelly Oubre or Jaylen Brown in Golden State, they would be just fine.
This is one of those cases where I'm really glad that you answered first, because if you had thrown that to me first, I would have gone straight into like the gushing mode of like how great Pat McCaw is.
He is great, and everybody should be pissed off that the Bucks sold that second round pick and allowed the Warriors to steal him, because they didn't need another advantage. Like Pat McCaw was great. I loved him coming into last year's draft, but
no, not only was I going to praise him, I was going to praise the Warriors culture for enabling him. And I was also going to praise the Warriors culture for shouting him out. I mean, that was one of the cooler things. Look, there was a lot of things happening yesterday's press conferences. I mean, it was a tour de force from a podium standpoint, no question. But to hear guys like KD, Kerr, and Curry be like, by the way, we just won this title, this was huge for us, but how about Pat McCaw? Like, that's kind of cool. Like, if you're that rookie on that team, you know, you make a couple baskets. Like, he was big in that game, there's no question. Like, unexpected, very timely buckets. But look, they're winning the title without Pat McCaw, right? But to have those guys come out and tell you, like, hey, good job, we appreciate you, way to step up, like, that's pretty awesome. And we should probably stop gushing now, otherwise I'm going to be running the risk of self-parody here. But it was cool.
Yeah, no, he was great. He was awesome. And he, like, talk about, imagine staring down the barrel of life in like Orlando or Charlotte or Milwaukee, or you get drafted onto Golden State. Like, Pat McCaw really hit the lottery on that one.
Well, just to reinforce our point about him, though, he needs to come back with an awesome hairstyle or accessory. Like, it's time.
Exactly.
Like, he crowned his career in Game 5. Like, he proved he belongs. He's going to be there because he's on that rookie deal for a while now. So, like, come back with a signature, Pat McCaw. Like, become that guy who lasts for decades.
Lean into your cult hero status. All right, three more questions here. David says, this was another one from midway through the finals. You called out Sharp on Friday's episode for being a greased pig, but you mentioned nothing about his shifting opinion on Kyrie Irving. Sharp was insistent that Kyrie is one of the NBA's 10 best players when SI's top 100 players was released. But now, if anything, you laud Kyrie more heavily than Sharp. What gives? Are Sharp's changing takes so frequent that it's difficult to remember them all? So, quick background. You emailed this person back defending me for some reason. Sometimes you get a little sensitive when people criticize me.
Oh, I do
but
a lot.
Then he went and listened to the podcast and realized that I was not arguing that he needed to be in the top 10, but was saying that 23 or wherever you had him was way too low for Kyrie. And I've brought all this up only to see if you will admit that I was dead right about both LaMarcus Aldridge and Kyrie Irving with the SI top 100.
Well, look, a broken clock is right occasionally. We do need to like have some positive reinforcement for you. No, here's what I'd say though. Nothing to lose Kyrie is unbelievable. I did a little preview piece on elimination game Kyrie. That's a real thing. I mean, the guy, when he's in Mamba mentality, it's a different level, and there aren't very many guys who can get to that level. I guess the problem that I have is, look, we're not just basing that top 100 off his peak moments, right? Like, what's his baseline? What's he doing over the course of 82 games? What's his track record as the leader? And I think some of his comments about LeBron that I referenced earlier kind of showed what he's trying to work on, right? Like, he's trying to get to that consistency factor. He's trying to get to that leadership role. He's trying to grow and expand his game, and you love him for it. And he's getting there, and he's had some wonderful moments in the finals. I guess the differentiation I would draw is, like, if I had to go to war and win one game, Kyrie's a lot higher on my list than if I had to build a team around him, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's why I thought that he belonged higher, is because in the games that matter, Kyrie is more valuable than almost all of his peers, aside from maybe like 10 to 12 others, and he belongs in that mix. But it's, first of all, the greased pig thing, when you said that on the podcast,
I got pissed.
I thought you were calling me a pig and wasn't really paying attention to the greased part, but Kyrie is sort of like a greased pig of a player, because there are a lot of nights when you watch him during the year and you're like, Jesus, like, has this guy ever tried on defense? And like, he's just an ISO king on offense. And when it's not working in February and LeBron is playing 45 minutes a game to keep the Cavs in it, you're like, Kyrie is pretty overrated. But then he has these moments in the playoffs where he's just unreal. Like, I had so much fun watching him more than anybody over the last 7 or 8 days. So shout out to Kyrie.
Yeah, well said. And just to answer his question, no, I can't keep track of Sharp's takes, guys. Like, I try, okay? Like, I keep score like crazy. Like, I'm over here with my journal. Like, how many have I gotten correct? How many has he gotten correct? You guys know I love the told you so. I try, okay? There's no pinning Sharp down. I called him a grease pig because he's a grease pig. You can't expect to get that guy in a pen, okay? He's unpennable.
Yeah, that's right. I think I'm taking that as a compliment.
Oh, it is.
Cassius says, who was the MVP of the whole playoffs, not just the finals? Who's on the all-playoff team? I'll let you answer.
Shout out, Cassius. Thank you for that question. It's a good one. I thought about writing on this. I didn't get a chance to. But I think we should group brainstorm, because I think one of the tricks is, how many guys who aren't on the Cavs and the Warriors deserve to be in this combo, right? Like, I think for sure Steph, KD, LeBron are in there. I think if we're doing like first team and second team, then that opens up spots for Kyrie, Love, Draymond, Clay, if you're taking into account defense as well. So already that's like half the available spots. Isaiah Thomas, I think we got to put into that mix. Kawhi Leonard, despite the ankle injury, I mean, we shouldn't forget how good Kawhi Leonard was the first two rounds. I mean, give me a break. Like, that guy had a great postseason. It should not be lost to history. Who else would you put in that mix? Maybe John Wall?
I don't know. I don't want to give away how bored I was by most of these playoffs, but I don't really give a shit.
What about DeMar DeRozan, Kyle Lowry, some of your favorite Raptors?
Yeah, Patrick Patterson for missing like 50 open looks against the Cavs. My playoff MVP is Kelly Oubre. I have never had... I think the peak of the playoffs was him body slamming Olynyk, and I honestly had more fun watching Celtics Wiz than like most of the rest of this postseason. But I'm also pretty biased, so whatever.
I think we should also shout out Giannis, Gordon Hayward.
Oh yeah, Giannis really only had like 5 or 6 days where he was great, but he was awesome in those moments and gave us hope for like whatever is coming after the Warriors. Like, yeah, I believe in Giannis.
For sure. And like I said, Hayward too. I mean, I think he might have played the best, the most consistently without getting the attention. I don't know if there's a snappy way to say that, the most overlooked or something like that, but I think that's where I put Hayward, and he was pretty strong. So that's sort of our rough all playoff team. But the scary part, I think the big takeaway, is it's completely dominated by the super teams, no question. Their stars, for the most part, all played exceptionally well. And, you know, barring a Love trade, they're all going to be back next year.
Yeah. All right. Final question. Speaking of Gordon Hayward, Lindsay in Utah has a story. She says, in 1997, I was a junior in college at the University of Utah. The Jazz were in the finals, and I took my little brother, age 12, to the carnival-like event the Jazz hosted outside the Delta Center before every game. There were bouncy houses, arcade games, live music, and a mini ball free throw contest to win tickets to the game. My brother was and is a diehard Jordan fan. He painted the walls of his bedroom North Carolina blue. Years later, he got married wearing Air Jordan 11s. I tried to do that, side note, but was talked out of it by family members. At the carnival-like event, he spent all his money playing the free throw game over and over and over. I was alternatively embarrassed and bored, but my brother was possessed. In the end, he sank what seemed like 100, but was probably just a dozen shots to beat a dude 3 times his age and won tickets to the game. And that is the story of how I ended up at the flu game, one of the most epic things I have ever witnessed in person. Happy 20th anniversary to the flu game. That was an awesome story. There's an unreal story. Yeah, you know, appreciate you passing that along. It brought back memories of watching that game, brought back memories. I was a huge Jordan fan and a huge North Carolina fan, but I never got to go to one of those games. So shout out to you, Lindsay.
Yeah, that made me incredibly jealous. And I think it's a great reminder, Andrew, that people should be sending emails to openfloormail@gmail.com. Well, look, you don't have to go to the flu game to email us your basketball stories. Like, you could run into Peja Stojakovic at the grocery store. You can share a cigarette with Vlade Divac. I mean, really, whatever you want to do in terms of your brushes with NBA greatness, let us know. But we want to hear about it. openfloormail@gmail.com. 5-star reviews on iTunes too, right?
Well, and also the second part of Lindsay's email was, per your request for questions about the rest of the league, where do the Jazz go from here and what are the odds they keep Gordon Hayward? And we're going to get into that later in the week.
Teaser.
Because this, as of last night, the summer of Gordo is upon us. Hayward's on the move. Blake Griffin's on the move. We got draft shit to talk about. We got Sixers rumors, Lakers rumors, Kings rumors. I am so excited for the dumb, strange version of the NBA to return. And we're going to have some fun this summer.
Yeah, we are, and it's going to start off with me picking the brain of the greased pig about draft prospects. Okay, guys, coming up here over the next week or two, like, I'm going to be playing catch up big time, trying to learn about some of these lottery guys, who's going to be impact players potentially for next season. Andrew has been slaving over this stuff for a couple months now. He lets it out in small doses, in little drips during the playoffs, but we're really going to dive into what he's the knowledge that he's accumulated, what he's learned about these guys. It's going to be awesome. We're going to learn a lot. 5-star reviews on iTunes, openfloormail@gmail.com. We love just the little notes too. You know, shout us out on Instagram. Go ahead, put your pity comments up. I see that every single day. Every picture I post, put these masterpieces on Instagram, ben.golliver. All I get back is pity comments. That's okay. We appreciate
you. The podcast is not complete until you've like clandestinely plugged your Instagram.
So I know. I think we
can end now.
No, let's do it.
Thank you to everybody for listening throughout the year. It's been a lot of fun, and it'll be a fun off season. Ben, go drive home. I'll talk to you soon.
Great season, Andrew. Take care, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.